Hey, it's Greg. Thanks for checking out the Toronto Today podcast. Well, Leaders Week, we've got Ontario Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca. We'll talk about his new transit plan that got a lot of attention, a lot of tongues wagging as well, thinking of money that could be saved, taking the TTC, taking the GO, going even outside of the GTA and utilizing transit. Josh Matlow wants us to be able to drink in parks. How do you feel about that? Well, some city councillors are on board, and some clearly weren't last year when he brought up the motion, but he's back to do it again. It happens in a lot of other world-class cities, so why not Toronto? That and much, much more, and of course the leak that got onto Politico's website that Roe v. Wade is in great jeopardy at the top of the top level of the Supreme Court of the United States. We'll touch on that as well. All coming up on Toronto Today, which starts now. Let me start here. If you saw it last night, there's news on the pro-choice, pro-life front. The Supreme Court has voted to strike down the landmark Roe v. Wade decision. Now, they didn't sit in chambers and vote. Not yet, anyway. But there is a draft majority opinion that got leaked. Who's the leaker and who's the leaky, I like to say? Who does this benefit to get this out there? My suspicion, I'll tell you about it in a couple minutes from now, but Politico got a hold of the document. And this is absolutely, to me, reading just some of the summary of it, and I'm no law expert. I wrote the LSAT, did decently, took some pre-law courses, stayed at a Holiday Inn Express once, all that stuff. But this seems to me a definitive repudiation of Roe v. Wade. More so than any other Supreme Court denotation before this. And it's something that is going to get a lot of traffic today. It's going to get a lot of traffic leading into the midterm elections, which are going to be, whether you like it or not, very problematic for the Democratic Party. Joe Biden still has his job, but a lot of senators will not. Even more, congressmen and congresswomen on the Democratic side will not. But Alito, Justice Samuel Alito, wrote the majority opinion. Here's some of the quote. Obviously, we don't have him reading it, so I'm going to sub in for Justice Samuel Alito in a little bit of a role play here. Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. We hold that Roe and Casey, which was a Planned Parenthood v. Casey case in 1992, this was leading up to Bill Clinton's election, Bill Clinton running against both Ross Perot and George Herbert Walker Bush, because this was during a Bush presidency and a Republican-held Senate. We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. That's what Samuel Alito writes in the document. It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives. Okay, two things on that. Then I'm going to let you hear from MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, who was emotional about this last night. The Constitution doesn't say anything. The Constitution of the United States says nothing about abortion. So when people, it's not for it, it's not against it. Amazingly enough, when people went to backyard barbecues in 1776, well, first of all, they were probably worried about getting beheaded or thrown in the river. But either way, those backyard barbecues didn't hold a lot of discussion about pro-life, pro-choice near the end of the 18th century. I know you're shocked. So am I. So was I to have read that. But nonetheless, it is that issue that we don't tend to bring up. It is that uncomfortable conversation about bodily autonomy, about when does a life become a life. You know that that's true. There's two things you really don't want to bring up at somebody else's house, unless you know them really, really well. What are they? Middle Eastern politics, pro-choice, pro-life. Those are about the two big things at the end of the day. Rachel Maddow said this while talking with Chris Hayes on MSNBC last night.
If this ruling is if the ultimate ruling from the court is going to look anything like this, and we're going into a midterm season where the Republicans are poised to take the House and the Senate, then, you know, President Biden is still President Biden, and he would presumably veto such a measure. But if in the event that we had a Republican president in 2024, that's where we'd be. We'd be at a, you know, South America-style nationwide abortion ban in America.
I'll read you this again. Samuel Alito wrote, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences. and it's been involved. It's been in the court system 50 years. It's been that defense, and it's been allowing women to have choice when it comes to their bodies. And far from bringing about a national settlement of the abortion issue, he continues, Roe and Casey have inflamed debate and deepened division. Well, two things on that. One, yes, it's always going to be a debated issue. It didn't matter whether it was Roe v. Wade, Smith v. Smith, Jones v. Smith, whatever. Of course, that was going to be the case. The decision in its essence, to the letter of it, of the law, is not what inflamed debate. The debate was there before Roe v. Wade. Deepening division, I could see that. I actually agree with that sentiment. But four of the other Republican-appointed justices, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, the latter two being Trump appointees, that's what they're there for. That is what they're there for. Kavanaugh and Barrett were put onto the Supreme Court to be pro-life and to be staunchly pro-life. I think what people didn't quite see coming is this conservative majority on the Supreme Court would kind of, snip, snip, snip away at abortion rights without just flipping this on its head, the 49-year-old case, and switching it around. Maddow goes on to make the point that timing over the next several months is key.
The fact that it's being leaked, this fact that this is being leaked now, we will have whatever the ruling is. We will have the ruling before the November election. This is like a four-number Sudoku. This isn't a very hard puzzle, right? This is, in terms of people figuring out what the stakes are of their vote in November, in terms of the midterms, putting whichever party in control of either House of Congress will, among other things, determine whether or not we're about to become a country that bans abortion nationwide.
That's Rachel Maddow on MSNBC last night. Here's the problem as well. Here's something Politico put out 10 points about the judgment here. The inescapable conclusion is that a right to abortion is not deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions. On the contrary, an unbroken tradition of prohibiting abortion on pain of criminal punishment persisted from the earliest days of the common law until 1973. Let me raise my hand and say, hold it a minute. We don't want laws from the 1700s or the 1800s or the early 1900s. We don't want, issues like Brown v. Board of Education or Plessy Ferguson. We don't want segregation in schools. We don't want black people not to be allowed to go into restaurants. And many of those laws existed until 55, 60 years ago also. So is there progress here or is there not? Now, some of you may wonder, what does this mean for Canada? I don't think it means very much. I think it would be really interesting to find out the perspective of some of the conservative leaders. I think Leslyn Lewis has put herself out there and said that she is staunchly pro-life, but I don't think we think Leslyn Lewis is in line to become the prime minister and, vis-a-vis the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. On the campaign trail in 2019, though, Andrew Scheer had to be out there and talking about this. And he had to have talks about gay marriage. And he also had to have talks about abortion. Here he is at a rally in central Ontario in the summer of 2019.
I'm personally pro-life, but I've also made the commitment that as leader of this party, it is my responsibility to ensure that we do not reopen this debate.
Yeah, there isn't the appetite for it here. I think there isn't the appetite even to talk about same-sex marriage. And Scheer was more vocal about that and obviously made the comparison that two people of the same sex was like marrying an animal, a domesticated animal, years earlier. And that video, obviously surfaced, video usually does, and it came back to haunt him to a great extent. Now, I'll say this about where we're at in terms of our political discourse. A lot of people are making the case, and I see why it's going to work. I don't necessarily agree, but I see this as going to work in the United States. Oh, let me get this straight. People on the left are talking about choices and bodily autonomy and an implied right to consent, even while understanding there's concerns from the other side of the debate. Okay, how did that go when it came to getting vaccinated? Not so well. And as somebody that would have encouraged mandates, been for mandates last July, August, and September, and am no longer in any context, it was meant to be for a short period of time. And at least in this case, I'm a man of my word. And many other people are as well. You saw the point in July, August, and September. You do not anymore. So there's a lot of outrage, and I understand it. I understand people, the idea of having a flip from pro-choice to pro-life so staunchly in the United States. I understand why there's outrage from the same people who were screaming for COVID vaccine mandates, and some still do, okay? So you might see bodily autonomy as something that's absolute and maybe a right of you as an adult. And you also can hear concerns from the other side of the debate. Look, millions of kids have disappeared from elementary schools. Pediatric suicide, high on the rise. Depression, high on the rise. 2 and 3 year olds wearing masks 35 hours a week. We have food shortages. And now you want everybody to mobilize and make 2022 just about abortion? Well, I'm with you. I am staunchly pro-choice. But I think it's going to be difficult to sway all the other people that you alienated to get the same energy and fuel up when you didn't care when they were talking about education, when you didn't seem to care when they were talking about bodily autonomy, and when you didn't seem to care about talking about how our younger people are doing and how we also isolated older people as well. I think those will be really interesting things to consider. And we're very pleased to welcome on the Ontario Liberal leader. He is Stephen Del Duca. It's great to have you on. Listen, if this goes long enough, you could be the first, and if things go right, you could be the first premier since John Robarts to welcome the Maple Leafs to a Stanley Cup parade. The legendary Bill Davis didn't even get to do this, Stephen.
My goodness, what a great occasion that would be. It would really make Ontario a place to grow. You know, that's hearkening back to those days.
Yeah, totally. So your transit announcement yesterday, a buck a ride. I'm fascinated by it. You know me, I live out in Ajax, and I always say, yep, if me and three friends come in on a Saturday to watch the Leafs, you know, when people like me can afford it, so we'd come during the regular season, it's going to cost us about $90 to get on the go together. And there's not a lot of incentive for a group rate. There's not a lot of so what do? We pile in the car probably instead, pay $30 to park, and it's not very efficient, and we feel a bit bad about driving. I'm sure people, those anecdotes like that are on your mind, but it's also people getting back to it after the pandemic. It's people that have to go to work. It's people that need to be on public transit 5 days a week. Am I right?
Yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, the story you just told, I think, is pretty typical, for example, across the Greater Toronto and Hamilton area and beyond in other communities like Ottawa and elsewhere. People who would prefer to take public transit, you don't have to worry about it impaired driving or any of those challenges that you don't want to have to experience, of course. And it's just not accessible enough. It's not affordable enough. You are 100% right. The ridership has plummeted during the pandemic with people working from home and also people who've been concerned about getting back on public transit. So by delivering $1 transit fares, buck a ride province-wide, as I like to call it, I think that will get ridership back up. It'll take about 400,000 cars off our roads. And it's going to make life more affordable for hardworking families in Ajax or Vaughan or elsewhere. And that's why I'm really excited about it.
Now, this is something that would be in place for around 18 months. So I think it's an obvious question. I'm sure you got asked it yesterday. Do you worry? You give something, I think we did this with newspapers for too long. They're free online. Then there's a paywall. Music, same thing for people who buy music. You're given something for borderline nothing. Can you then push the prices back to similar rates to where they're at now, 18 months later, and then not have an uproar?
Yeah, listen, it's a great question. And I did get asked the question yesterday, not surprisingly. And here's what I've said. I want to, in our own budgeting for this particular commitment, we anticipate ridership will grow. So in year one, we think we expect that it's going to cost or we'll have to invest about $710 million. In year two, because we expect ridership will grow, we've budgeted $1.1 billion. What I've said is that as premier, I would want to work closely with mayors across the communities that have public transit to make sure, and with Metrolinx and Go at the table, to make sure that we collectively make decisions that make sense. To me, this is about priorities. And for me, as a former transportation minister and someone who loves transit, who wants to expand transit everywhere, this is something that I'm really committed to. And I think here in this province, we collectively, you know, the mayors, the premier, frankly, even the federal government at the table, we can find creative ways to make sure that transit remains affordable.
Stephen Del Duca is our guest on Toronto Today on 640 Toronto. Are people who don't use public transit subsidizing this? I grew up in London, Ontario. I might have come to Toronto, taken the subway four times in my first 25 years of life. My parents kind of same thing in a half century. Does somebody say across Ontario, I'm nowhere near the GTA. I'm nowhere near where I could even get on a bus. Are they paying for this?
Well, think about it this way. There are, so first of all, it would apply to all municipal transit. So someone growing up like you did in London today would be able to hop on the local transit system, and it would be a dollar a ride there. By the way, we're also knocking monthly passes down to $40. So that's a huge savings for those who are purchasing those monthly passes. You know, we have about 100, 105 municipalities in this province that run their own transit systems. But those 100, 105 municipalities represent somewhere around 75 or 80% of Ontario's population. In other words, it is the overwhelming number of Ontarians who do have some degree of access to public transit. I want more of them to take public transit. I want the ridership to grow everywhere in this province. While we continue to expand transit options, making it more affordable is good for the environment. It's good for people's pocketbooks. And I think it's the exact kind of relief that people want right now.
I think about Toronto a lot. I drive downtown every day in the morning because there's no transit available that early. And I think about the city, and I do think people need to be in the city more. I'm sure you've thought about this, too, that we look at a lot of North American cities, New York, Chicago, Toronto, and we say, I'm sure you'll have these conversations with John Tory. We need a vibrant city. We need a lively city. We can't just come in for a big Leafs game or a big concert or the CNE. And I wonder if you sort of wrestle with that, with the going back to work. You mentioned a 4-day work week, and that appeals to a lot of people who want to be better parents, who want to spend more time with their family, and bosses might want more, more employees that aren't burned out. Is there a fine line between keeping big cities vibrant and alive and businesses going and allowing people more options to work from home?
You know, I don't think that I think all of those things can be accomplished. Again, first of all, you've got to be, as a premier, you've got to be at the table working collaboratively with mayors. You mentioned John Tory. With someone like John Tory and all of the other mayors and councils we have across the city, we have the various organizations at local and regional levels that help support tourism options, for example. And I think that we did learn during the pandemic that we can be very creative, whether it's in Toronto or elsewhere. Under the most difficult circumstances we've had to face in generations, we did find ways to help open up more opportunities for pedestrian-only sections of the province, for example, or the city, for example. The way that bars and restaurants were able to expand their patio spaces. We saw an announcement from Mayor Tory just yesterday about expanding options for bringing more people into the city over the course of the next summer, the summer months that are about to be upon us. We hope with the weather getting better soon. So I think there's lots of ways for us to deal with this. But here's the thing. By making public transit only $1 per ride, I'm talking about the GTHA for a second, from one end to the other, it'll be so much more affordable for a family of four or five or whatever it is to hop on a GO train or a streetcar or a subway car to get where they want to go, to see an attraction, to support our local economy. And, you know, I have to believe it's going to have significant economic uplift at a local level, which we desperately need after this pandemic.
Stephen Del Duca is kind enough to join us on Toronto Today. I feel like your campaign, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, I think it's moved on the COVID front. You will. I know you will. It's moved from restrictions and mandates to drilling down on what the Ford government got wrong in the first 20 months or so. And I got all day to talk about that. Long-term care, schools not being prepared. I got all the time in the world for that. But I think people have decided that they, and I talked to some of your MPPs, they want and MPP candidates, they want to manage their own risk. I think they want those conversations about healthcare, increasing healthcare capacity. But that's what I see to some extent. Am I way off? I think people do a lot of the predictions from the science table, from some of the more prominent doctors. Stephen, they haven't materialized. I don't want to call them wrong instead of right, but they haven't materialized in our hospitals and our ICUs blowing up since the mask mandate were lifted. So they are more wrong than right, but I won't call them outright wrong. What's your thought on it?
Well, look, I think that we've learned a couple of things. Well, I hope we've learned a couple of things during the pandemic that will help us as we go forward, will help us guide the decisions that we make around healthcare, around our resiliency, around public health, around education and long-term care, as you mentioned. One of those lessons for me is that it is better to be vigilant and cautious and to make a tougher decision, what feels like a tougher decision earlier on in a process, rather than having to grudgingly be dragged to the right decision the way that Doug Ford was repeatedly over the course of the last couple of years, which I do think made a tough situation for Ontarians dramatically worse at some critical moments, which I believe was unnecessary. But again, being cautious, being vigilant, we still know a lot of, we've talked about this before on your program, a lot of our youngest kids haven't necessarily gone to get the vaccine. I think there's a conversation we have to have on an ongoing basis around that. I think we have to look at our healthcare system and make sure that we build in that exceptionality and resiliency so we have enough nurses and personal support workers and doctors to withstand future challenges. So again, these are just some of the lessons that I've taken to heart as someone who's running to be premier about how we will go forward and build fundamental public systems, particularly in healthcare and education, that are strong enough to deal with future challenges.
You did call, it's in the party platform to call for universal vaccinations for schools. And you and I have talked about this before. There's so much natural immunity, acquired immunity post-Omicron. So many people you know and I know, their households were hit by Omicron, and the vast majority of them ended up recovering. I see the numbers today, 35.3% of 5 to 11s are vaccinated. Where do we stand on that? I don't know where we go with the mandates. I was adamantly for them in July, August, and September, but I know in our subsequent conversations, I don't know where we go with them. Again, we have 40,000 people watching sports last night in the city, and nobody knows who's vaccinated. And I feel like the majority of people are okay with that now.
Yeah, look, I think I've said this from the very beginning. You and I have talked about it before. I think, you know, adding the COVID-19 vaccination to the list of or the roster of universal vaccines makes a lot of sense. I've said that from the very beginning. I feel very comfortable and very strongly about that. I think there's a reason that we have, I believe it's 8 or 9 existing vaccines on that universal roster. I think adding this one is the right thing to do, and especially since in many of our schools across the province, even today, the absences or the absentee rate for students is still higher than I would like it to be. You know, depending on where you are in the province, it's 10%, 15% on a per school basis, in some cases a little bit higher, of students who are not in school right now for a variety of reasons. So that doesn't make me feel comfortable as someone running to be premier, because I think learning needs to be universal, and it needs to be essential, and it needs to be resilient enough so our kids are getting the very best start and the very best chance to succeed. And that's why I've called for making the COVID-19 vaccine universal, and I stand by that.
And I know we only got about a minute, but are these, where are we now? I have so many parents that say, my kid has 2 doses, like mine. My kid had Omicron, like one of mine did. So there are many conversations about whether that universal vaccine is now 2 shots, 3 shots. There's a lot of complications to this. So where does the Liberal Party stand on that?
Yeah, look, I think the best thing to do on this kind of topic, even though they're not necessarily infallible, I think the best way is to be guided by public health expertise. And we are blessed in this province to have a ton of women and men who've been on the front lines of this from the very beginning, whether it's on the science table or elsewhere, to get that guidance. I've said this from the very beginning. We as Ontario Liberals believe in science. We believe in evidence-based decision making. And I'm not a medical expert. I'm not an epidemiologist, but I am comfortable enough in my own skin to know what I don't know, Greg. And that's why I would want to rely on those who've studied this, who understand it deeply, and be guided by their advice.
Ontario Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca, June 2nd is our Ontario provincial election. Thank you very much for making a generous time for our audience. They enjoy hearing your views. Thank you very much again, and I hope we can do this again before June 2nd.
For sure. Thanks, Greg. Have a great day.
You got it. You too. Stephen Del Duca, our guest. So Sheba Siddiqui joins me right now. I know you were listening intently to the Stephen Del Duca conversation, because you said a lot more conversations about 4-day work weeks. And maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, when I was labeled the Don Draper of Chorus Radio, only for my desire to have a healthy, vibrant workplace and no smoking in it. Also, that's different from Mad Men. But nonetheless, the 4-day work week is something that is still, it's still a conversation point. Work from home is a conversation. The 4-day work week and it ties in together.
So everywhere I went, yesterday was Eid, and everywhere I went, even the congregation, like even the imam that was talking, I'm telling you, like parties, people, friends, family, everyone was talking about the 4-day work week. That was the one thing. Obviously, there was vaccines and masks and all that, which I'm sick of talking about. But another focus of the conversation was the 4-day work week. And you asked him the question. We just had Stephen Del Duca on, and you asked him the question, and he kind of dodged it and started talking about transit and John Tory. And It's not just him. I get really frustrated with these politicians, all of them across the board, who they've become masters of just not answering the question. No matter how direct someone is to them, they know they have their talking points. They want to hit their talking points, and that's that. But I personally love the idea of a 4-day work week, especially after the conversations I had yesterday. I know you hate it. I know
I hate
you absolutely.
It.
I know you do.
But I don't think we can do our job. What do we do? Do a longer show?
I'm not here. I wasn't born to solely do my job. That's not my main. I love my job. You know that. You know I love doing this. I love what we do. But this is not my whole end all be all of my life. I need balance, and I feel, and one focus. What's the biggest issue that we've had? One of the biggest issues during the pandemic: mental health. I feel like a 4-day work week, 3 days off, I think that would solve a lot of that. I think it would bring so much balance into people's lives, family time. You can go golfing 3 days a week now, right? You can go, you'll have your boys around to connect with them.
Okay, but so do you want, I can't see school being 4 days a week, because the 4-day work week works for certain jobs. It does not work for this job. It doesn't work for a radio show. There's no way it works. If you're talking a 9-to-5 scenario where you're selling, processing something, you're a buyer, you're an accountant, I think you can do that stuff. I think you can be a lawyer 4 days a week. But what do we do with our kids? I don't think we can up the learning into pack longer school days in.
Bring in OAC. Bring in OAC, give them a four-day work week. The one thing that I have noticed, my kids have all fallen behind.
I'd be all for grade 13 coming back. I wouldn't have a problem with that.
We're all catching up. Academically, they're all catching up. Every child is catching up because of what they've missed, because of virtual school, because of schools being closed, whatnot, whatever it is. But we have gotten so much closer as a family because we were locked in the house together for 2 years. Let's say a year of it, we were actually locked in with the lockdowns and whatnot. And, you know, fear of what it was in the very beginning of the pandemic. We have gotten so much closer. We have bonded so much more. For me, like, family is number one.
And it should be. But I don't think you can do K-8 4 days a week. I don't think you can ask teachers to teach 9 or 10 hour days. And so you're chopping off 20% of the school time.
No, don't teach 9 or 10 hour days. No, keep the work day as it is. Keep the school day as it is.
I'm paying for my education via tax for my kids, and I lose 20. You're cutting out 20% of my kids' learning? I'm not for that.
Okay, then bring those taxes down. For schools.
I'm not going to ask Stephen Del Duca that, because I know what that answer is going to be.
But
you think he wants to give us tax money?
Your conversation is going back to the economy, right? Even with work from home, you're like, what about downtown?
I care about business owners in the city, and I care about people who own shops. The economy is people. The economy is people and families.
Then find a way to get people living downtown to support those businesses.
How do I lower those rental costs for a condominium? Gord, would you like a condo downtown? Oprah giving out condos and cars?
It is
your responsibility.
No, it isn't. My responsibility is my mental health and my family. So there's a way to do it. We have to work some things out. Yes, absolutely. Lots of conversations need to be had. But mental health first. And I think a 4-day work week would really bring that into people's households.
It's possible.
And you're right. It's not possible for every type of job. Absolutely. But for those who can do it, absolutely.
So the big news yesterday, we had Stephen Del Duca on this morning, and his big news was a buck a ride, obviously. And he made the point that this is province-wide. I know there's people that think this is very GTA-centric or even GTHA-centric. Stephen Del Duca told us this earlier this hour.
In our own budgeting for this particular commitment, we anticipate ridership will grow. So in year one, we think we expect that it's going to cost, or we'll have to invest, about $710 million. In year two, because we expect ridership will grow, we've budgeted $1.1 billion. What I've said is that as premier, I would want to work closely with mayors across the communities that have public transit to make sure, and with Metrolinx and Go at the table, to make sure that we collectively make decisions that make sense. To me, this is about priorities, and for me, as a former transportation minister and someone who loves transit, who wants to expand transit everywhere, this is something that I'm really committed to. And I think here in this province, we collectively, you know, the mayors, the premier, frankly, even the federal government at the table, we can find creative ways to make sure that transit remains affordable.
So many issues there. I mean, that excites some people. It concerns others. Ben Spurr is transportation reporter for the Toronto Star and always has some great stuff and scoops. He's moving beats, as a matter of fact, to City Hall. But he's kind enough to join us now. Just in time to head to the municipal beat from transportation. Ben, with this in the works, were you more cynical about Stephen Del Duca's announcement, or do you see that there's some potential to get people back and get engagement back on the streetcars and the GO train and the subway again?
Yeah, it's a really interesting proposal for sure. When you speak to experts about this kind of thing, though, there is some skepticism about the idea that it's going to actually boost ridership. I think there's a kind of broad agreement that lower fares are good, especially for people who are struggling financially, and this could help them out. But the experts I've spoken to say that fare cost is not necessarily the major driver of boosting ridership, and things like more reliable service, bringing service to parts of cities that aren't served right now, that kind of thing will actually do a lot more to boost ridership than actually slashing the cost of fares.
I wondered about that point, because I think when things either start free or we make things free, it's hard to mobilize people then to pay regular prices again. Your industry is a great example, with newspapers online, or even what we do in radio, or when music was free and then all of a sudden it's $1.29 a song. People kind of think, can I still get around that? And transit will be a big move if we go back to regular. Like, I live in Ajax. It costs $20 to come downtown round trip. And so if you're doing that five times a week, it adds up. But I do wonder if we have 18 months of sort of, Shangri-La with transit prices, and then we jack it back up again. People are going to, they're not going to sit well.
Yeah, I think, the impact on longer trips, like GO trips, of course, where the fares are higher, is going to be bigger than in the TTCs, for instance, where cutting the cost to a dollar is about, $2 off the fare as it is right now. But if you think about it, like, the reason why people aren't taking transit right now, of course, as they were before the pandemic, is because they just have fewer places to go. Mm-hmm. Even people who are going back to the office are not going back five times a week. So whether or not it costs $3.25 to get to the office or $1, if you don't have no reason to go to the office, you're not going to ride necessarily, right? And I think the other issue is that, if you think about if someone has chosen not to take transit, it's not necessarily because the cost is too high, right? If they have a car, that's more expensive than taking transit in most cases, but they've decided that it's more convenient for them, right, to take them from A to B and get somewhere they need to go. They don't have to wait around, half an hour at a bus stop necessarily. So, reducing the cost of the ride from $3.25 to $1, it's not necessarily going to make that person ditch their car and all the kind of convenience that it offers them. So I think actually providing more convenient service, more reliable service, a lot of transit experts have told me that's what's really going to boost transit ridership.
Ben Spurr is kind enough to join us on Toronto Today, transportation reporter for the Toronto Star. I recall the pre-pandemic era where express trains were just packed. You'd race. I used to do a 1-to-4 shift for about a year, and you'd sprint down on the subway to get maybe a 4:40 express train, and you were standing probably for 40 of the 55 minutes. Do we ever get back to those kind of levels on our trains, our subways, our streetcars, our buses again, or has the pandemic shifted all of those expectations and those targets?
Experts have told me on this that we will probably eventually get back, but it's going to take a couple of years. That it looks like a major driver of ridership, of course, commuting has probably changed for good. That people aren't going to be back in downtown offices 5 days a week, but they will be back a couple of days a week. So ridership will return in that sense, and just the city hopefully will keep growing. Right, that the population will keep growing due to just natural growth and immigration and that kind of thing, and so you will eventually see in a couple of years time ridership reach what it was before, but it's not happening in the next year or so. It's going to take a significant amount of time.
It's significant that you're moving to the City Hall beat, because we've been talking internally as a show and talking about how It's a very chicken and egg principle. Getting people back to office workplaces downtown will stimulate economic growth, but economic growth can't be like, we can't just do it coming in for the odd concert or a Jays game or whatever. There needs to be a flow of A to B at least a few times a week to make downtown businesses, whether you're buying a shirt downtown or it's your dry cleaner or a bar. Those things aren't good. Those places aren't going to flourish. And I worry long term about the city of Toronto. It's a pretty massive city. We need to stimulate the economy, and we can't do that, I feel like, if our workplaces aren't at least half full.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, I'm not necessarily an expert on office usage and that kind of thing, but it does seem like it is starting to trickle back, and that this idea that downtown's going to be kind of abandoned for forever is hopefully not going to be the case. We're starting to see some people come back, and TTC ridership has started to bump up a bit more. I should say too that Del Duca's plan, he does speak about investing in more service, spending about $375 million, I believe it is, a year on providing more service to transit agencies across the whole province. That doesn't necessarily, go a long way, given the TTC's budget is, something like $2 billion. So not a huge boost necessarily for more service, but he is hoping to add some service that would hopefully attract people back and make it more attractive to, for instance, coming to downtown by transit.
Ben, thanks so much for coming on the show. Congratulations on the new beat. It was great to talk today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for the congratulations.
You bet. We were talking with Stephen Del Duca earlier about transit and a few other issues as well. Let's go shift to the municipal side of things as well. This is something that got brought up, I think, very much in a pandemic light and with a pandemic, focus. But the idea of having a beer or a glass of wine in the park, especially a year ago at this time, right? Nothing was open. Nothing was. Golf courses, pickleball, tennis, gyms, bars, none of it. And our next guest, city councilor, brought this to council. It got rejected. Some of the responses are pretty, fantastical, if you will, a year later. But Toronto City Councilor Josh Matlow, kind enough to join Toronto Today right now. You know, I'm a big fan of yours. We always like having you on. We'd like to have you on more often. But I will say I'm probably not the only person yesterday that Googled Josh Matlow alcohol yesterday. Like that's bound to happen, right? It's not a character statement. It's not a flaw on your part. And I support what you're doing here. So I did that Google search went into the workplace computer yesterday. It did.
Well, the appreciation is mutual, Greg, and it's great to be back with you. and the funny thing is, during the darkest days of the pandemic, as you said, the emphasis of this proposal was largely about how, experts were telling us we shouldn't be congregating indoors with each other because it wasn't safe, because it added to the transmission of the virus, and we needed outdoor space to go more safely. And while, there are some of us who have the privilege of having a backyard or a balcony, there are many Torontonians who don't. And they also wanted an opportunity to be able to safely see a friend or a family member. And the parks were the only place to go. And as you said, for everybody, there just wasn't anything else to do but go to the parks in many cases. But, the appreciation of going to parks and the value that we have about our outdoor spaces hasn't gone away, even as the pandemic has seemed to wane. And the rules have still remained unchanged that leave Torontonians in a completely inequitable situation. There are people who still can enjoy a drink with a friend in their backyard, but they're still prohibited under the rules from doing so in a park. And the proposal that I'm putting forward, doesn't change anything about the rules when it comes to bad behavior. So anyone who says, people are just going to go and, we're going to see another Trinity Bellwoods explosion again, or people are going to just start acting really, really badly. The reality is people who act badly and irresponsibly don't care about the rules anyway.
That's right.
So
great point.
There's still, it's not like the average reasonable, responsible person is just going to lose their minds because they're allowed to have, a drink, having a picnic with a friend. That enforcement is there. We actually want to free up resources to actually go after people who really do behave badly. That should be our target. But for the average person, let responsible adults just live their lives. And, you know, rules should be there to protect us from the bad things. But, you know, for responsible adults, they should be able to do, you know, as they wish in public spaces. And in this case, you know, I want to see a city where we encourage people to, you know, go out and enjoy our city. And this is one way to do it.
100%. And it's, you know, there's an element of the human condition we have to recognize. There's an element of what the human condition's been pushed into these last 26, 27 months. I'll read the audience this comment last year at this time from Dr. Eileen Davila. Look, I think Dr. Davila has a tough job. I think there's some things she's done I've admired. But I don't think this comment ages well. When alcohol becomes part of the picture, we know people become uninhibited and they're less able and less likely to adhere to self-protection measures. And I'm going, yes, at a certain point in time, but not after a glass of beer and then we shouldn't be having it at sporting events because everybody would run onto the field or throw things. Well, and we shouldn't be having it at concerts like the one I'm going to tonight because I'm going to think I can do a bass solo and jump on stage. There's still an element of individual accountability and responsibility 100%. that we have to have in our society. Of course there is.
Well, Greg, I would add that, you know, I have a lot of respect for Dr. Davila, but there were dissenting opinions a year ago when I moved the motion initially. Dr. Zane Chagla, Dr. Isaac Bogosh, very credible, reputable experts were all in favor of what we were putting forward because they knew that it would actually contribute to not only people's quality of life, but it would mitigate the transmission of the virus. And, you know, at this point, the reality is that the city is all in favor of Cafe TO, for example,
right,
where, you know, we are very deliberately supporting small businesses and supporting a great vibrant cafe culture in Toronto, which I love. But we are recognizing that people are going to not just have a tuna fish sandwich at a patio. You know, people are going to have a beer sometimes. And so let's not be hypocritical. Like if we're supporting the private industry and we're supporting having people pay for drinks at a restaurant, then why should we not be consistent and say if people who, whether it be affordability or whether it be another, you know, impediment for them to be able to enjoy that experience with a friend, why shouldn't we also allow them to do that in a public park? The average person doesn't act bonkers at a park when they're having a drink or two. That's just not realistic. And I think that we should just, you know, worry about the things to actually worry about and not make up excuses just to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think there's more than enough occasions where we can do that. But I don't think we want, to be ratting out our neighbors that we live with and that are our friends in a park. And I'd make this case, too, since the legalization of marijuana, I smell it in the park and I don't partake, but I shrug my shoulders and I go, they get to do that. It seems rather silly that I can't invite maybe an older friend. And by the way, Josh, still with the pandemic, we can have great debate about where we're at in terms of being out of it, into it. But maybe someone lives with an older parent and has an immunocompromised kid at home.
Absolutely.
So they want to meet me in the park instead of meeting me in my backyard or in my basement. I want to accommodate them there and be able to do that. I walk through these parks and it smells like a Steve Miller Band concert in some of these parks. So it seems silly. I can't have a glass of beer in a park as well.
Totally. And it's all about, it is inequitable that some people have a place outdoors to have a drink with a friend and others don't. We live in a city where roughly half of Torontonians are tenants. Many people don't have outdoor access at their homes. So, you know, we do need to respond to that reality. And the other thing, as you said, you can legally smoke a joint almost anywhere in our city. Mm-hmm. But you can't have a beer. And, you know, the reality is that if somebody has a beer, you're not getting hit by a waft of smoke. So like the reality is, let's just, if people should be able to have fun and enjoy themselves in responsible ways that don't have an adverse impact on others. And that's what this proposal does. And by the way, even within the motion, I'm asking for better access to waste disposal, better access to bathrooms, things that actually we should be doing anyway right now, because the things that people complain about when it comes to bad behavior in parks, they're already complaining about it because it's already happening. What I'd like to see is the public space to actually mitigate the bad things and accommodate the good things, because that's how you build a city that actually accommodates all of us. And, you know, I let's not be afraid just because we think somebody's going to act badly. If they're going to act badly, they're already doing it. They don't care about the bylaws.
100%. Josh Madlow joining us, Ward 12 City Councilor from Toronto St. Paul's. Let's go macro a little bit for our last question, because the council is going to look pretty different in the fall. And I know it's such a long run-up, and October seems forever away, but May seemed forever away last Christmas. So Joe Cressy won't be back. It doesn't feel like Kristen Wong Tam will be back, certainly not if she becomes an MPP. How do you see council's importance growing? How do you see council changing? And I know you're all looking forward to being able to do things and legislate and govern in a non-pandemic, you know, three-year span here. It's what you've been missing. It sounded like that's the motivation for Mayor Tory to come back, is he just couldn't get done what he wanted to get done in his second term.
Well, I mean, the reality is, even throughout the pandemic, a lot of good work was done. It didn't always get the headlines because obviously we were all focused on the pandemic, just even in general discussion in our society, because it impacted us the most. But there's so much more work that needs to be done. I mean, I think the biggest issue facing society today is the lack of access to housing that people can afford, and just, you know, the inaffordability of even household items today. And, you know, we need to collectively, every level of government needs to do their part to try to make life easier for people. So I want to see the city really act on providing more options for people to be able to live in the city and not just be pushed out of the city because they can no longer afford to live here. You know, we need to do things to improve, you know, like the small piece that I'm bringing forward, but frankly, there are many things that we need to improve our public realm, our streetscape, make the city function better. And ultimately, you know, I really do hope that if we elect a council that is thoughtful, you know, more pragmatic than ideological, and really wants to, you know, get work done, we can make a lot of progress. A big, you know, what's important to us as well is who is elected provincially, because ultimately cities in Ontario only have the powers or the lack of powers due to what kind of provincial government we have. So I'll digress there, but I can tell you that I'm paying a lot of attention to who is elected provincially, because that's going to have a big impact about the work that we can do locally.
Well, let's visit again before June 2nd and expand more on that, because I think it's equally important. Josh, thanks very much for making the time for our audience today. I always appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Someone came in late to our discussion with Josh Matlow and said, what was the, I'll read it. What was the Dr. Eileen Davila quote? Not a high point here, I feel like. She's urging people to she's urged city council not to allow having a beer or a glass of wine in a park. Here's the quote. When alcohol becomes part of the picture, we know people become uninhibited and they're less able and less likely to adhere to self-protection measures. Oh my gosh. Anthony Fury joins me right now. That's a top five Dr. Davila quote from the last 27 months. You're not going to push five at me that I would roll my eyes at more than that one.
So, sorry, are you telling me something that happened back in 2020? Are we doing a greatest hits, or did this just happen the other day?
Late April 2021 quote.
Well, I got something else to tell you. I walked by Trinity Bellwoods Park over the weekend, and there were people having a good time there, Greg. Not impressed at all. We got to sound the alarm. I can't believe that she said that.
You can believe it. You can believe it, though.
It's par for the course. Reefer madness. Remember those old movies?
Oh, my God.
We're back. COVID madness.
By the way, is this the first spring we haven't? Did they paint the circles? I remember that was like a lead story last year at this time. The circles are going back down at Trinity Bellwoods Park. Oh my gosh.
Circles are back. The aliens come every year, the COVID aliens, and they spray paint them in the crops, you know, when we're not looking. I can't believe we're back to this.
Good for Josh Matlow, right? You have no problem with this whatsoever. A ton of world-class cities do this, including Edmonton.
Oh, wow. It is unbelievable, the situation that we're in, that we're even having these conversations right now. It's like, all right, Eileen, you know, we got to just step away from all of this now. We've got a ghost away. Bonnie Henry, all credit to her. She was saying, she was saying she herself needs to ghost away. She's like, you guys don't need to see me anymore. Look, these people, they're paid like $250, $350K a year or whatnot. You can have the option of having a very stressful job, or you're going on the news telling people run away from the crop circles, or you can still make the $350 and just not have to worry about all this high stress stuff. Like it was, these positions existed before. We had a chief medical officer of Ontario for decades before we actually knew we had one and before we knew what they did. And they still made the same coin. So I don't know. I think they should just take it easy now.
Important to point out, no alcohol over 15% alcohol content would be allowed in parks. So that blind dog bourbon that you love so much, Anthony, that's you can't
I didn't go to Trinity Bellwoods.
That's right.
I knew I wouldn't be allowed.
You can't mix up a zombie or a Long Island iced tea in Hyde Park and watch the cherry blossom. You can't turn it into Tom Cruise and cocktail flicking bottles around. That's not what we're talking about here. Well, I am adamantly against
that. Ultra party, and that's why I ain't going.
That's right. That's a good point by you. So this back to work thing, we had Stephen Del Duca on about it. We were talking about the transit, about the return to work. It's very chicken and egg. I love the city of Toronto, adore the city of Toronto. And I feel like I got to drive downtown every day. I should be here. I get the drill. I don't love paying for gas. I don't love the commute, blah, blah, blah. But I worry that that the city of Toronto will suffer if all of us, we can't just come in for Leafs games and the odd concert. We gotta be here and make the city vibrant. But I feel like I'm not preaching to the choir here, and a lot of people disagree and they want to be at home more.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a variety of perspectives here. And I was against when John Tory a few months ago said he was going to mandate City of Toronto workers returning to City Hall. And the whole reason was to get people back in the path and to get them shopping at the Eaton Centre, because there's thousands of employees, of course, and otherwise they'd be eating lunch out at the food court. So I said, whoa, no, I don't support this. He said, but Fury, you're the guy who tells everyone it's totally always been safe to walk around the retail outlets. And it's true, but I also support the choice. So if people, for whatever reason, they're still skittish about COVID, I don't want to go into the office, okay, that's fine. Or this new hybrid stuff. I mean, I remember the first column I wrote on telework was ages ago, many years ago, talking about how that's an alleviation to our transit woes, our traffic, our congestion woes. And politicians, they asked staff to create reports on enhancing telework. Well, now we finally have it, so let's make use of that opportunity. And I think, Greg, most people are saying they want the hybrid. They want to go in 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. Depends where you're at. The people in their 20s who really like the, you know, the 4 p.m. drinks culture, people hanging out at the office, they like that whole vibe. They're going to do it. They're going to spend more time. The people who want the family balance, who want to be up to, okay, I got to pick the kids up from school at 3:30. Then I'll go back to the desk. I'll work again until 5:30. They're going to want to be at home for 2-3 days a week. And I think places are kind of figuring it out.
I think they are too. And there are two different conversations, right? I think work from home and the 4 day work week are two very different conversations. Sheba and I were talking about the 4 day work week, and I'm thinking, I want kids in school 5 days a week. I know how hard our good educators work, and I don't want them trying to squeeze in more curriculum, and I don't want to lose. We need more schooling, not less schooling at this point in time, and given what we've lost and what we've especially lost in Ontario. But I don't want the day extrapolated out. I think in high school, too, there's high schools, Anthony, that you know, they get out at 4 o'clock now because they start at 10, and that cuts into the ability to play sports after, or a part-time job, or any of that stuff that 16, 17, driving lessons even, any of those 16, 17-year-olds want to do. We got to get back to what we were and then reevaluate from there, but school has to be 5 days a week. So working 4 days, going to school 4 days, I don't like that combo.
No, it's a good point. It sends us in a completely different direction. I mean, I think it's good that people have talked about the life-work balance a little bit more. You know, in European countries, they make a point of maxing out their vacation time, and work is a thing that they don't need laws that tell them they're entitled to put their work phones down at 5 p.m. or on the weekends. It's just not a part of their culture. They manage to just check out and go live and do other things and really draw that distinction. Whereas one of the big challenges, and I know why a lot of people would like to go into the office for a few days a week, is because we've blurred what is work and what is family time. It's totally awesome to be able to turn on the dishwasher or the clothes dryer in the middle of the day, get those tasks done while you're technically also working. But at the same time, where does it begin? Where does it end? You can just wake up and work until it's bedtime. And that's causing a lot of challenges for a lot of people, drawing that work-life balance.
Yeah, I think it is. Do you have a thought on where we are with? I know you spotted what happened south of the border, the Politico leak, and I think clearly when Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett get put to the Supreme Court justice bench, that they've got a design in mind, and the design was to put justices on that would flirt, if you will, with dumping Roe v. Wade. I don't ever see that debate arriving back here in Canada. I don't ever do. Obviously, it was something the Liberals tried to push on Andrew Scheer, and Scheer was saying, I'm pro-life, but I will not reopen this debate. But that wasn't even enough for some people. It doesn't feel like that debate's coming here. What would you say about that?
Well, I'm sure for some people it's immediately come here, because one of the things that's so tedious is how we have to do the Canadian spinoff of the U.S. version every time on every issue. We can't just let it sit. So people are instantly going to try and import it here and find ways to say things are happening when they're not. It's a whole different landscape in the U.S. I mean, I think on every issue, everything is always more extreme on both sides. In terms of the pro-life activism is much more extreme down there. And I'd also say that the pro-choice, or even called the pro-abortion activism, is much more extreme in the U.S., whereas we're, I think, just a lot more chill about that here. Strong views, strong passions. There are the pro-life voices who wish Canada had some version of a law. We actually don't have any law in the books, whereas in the U.S., even in the most liberal states, they do have a lot of restrictions on third trimester abortions, and they do in many European countries. So that's kind of where the activism is here in Canada on that landscape. But I mean, a lot of people don't take it up. A lot of conservatives here would register themselves as pro-choice.
Do you think it even hurts? You bring me into that. Do you think it even hurts a candidate or even a incumbent politician? Would it hurt Doug Ford today if someone said, "Hey, are you watching what happens in the States?" And he said, "I am pro-life, but I won't open this up." Does that even hurt him by saying the words, "I'm pro-life"? I know plenty of people in my life that are pro-life. I'm pro-choice, but I respect their opinion to be pro-life. I don't think they're bad people by saying they're pro-life.
Well, look, we had Stephen Harper in office for 10 years. He had a majority for the last 4 years. And there's always the hidden agenda, the secret conservative agenda of Stephen Harper. And when he got his majority, there was no secret agenda. Nothing happened. The guy never mentioned abortion. Nobody ever really knew what his personal views on it were. I would say Leslyn Lewis is probably the most high-profile social conservative voice in Canada right now. I did a one-hour podcast with her, and I'm trying to think what was really her position on abortion. And probably, I guess she's kind of pro-life, but she doesn't really make it a big issue in terms of being very vocal about wanting to push for it. I don't even think there's a hidden agenda there on her part. I mean, I'm sure, you know, some tertiary aspects of the issue, she'd maybe want to do some, I don't know. All I'm saying is not even the most vocal people are vocal about it.
No, they're not. They're not. Anthony, love our chats. Thanks very much for the time today.
All the best. Thank you, sir.
Hey, it's Greg. Thanks for checking out the Toronto Today podcast. We'll be back with a live show tomorrow at 5:30 in the morning until 9 a.m. Lots to recap from this particular Tuesday, including the official announcement of the Ontario election to come on June 2nd. And we'll talk to Andrea Horvath on the show tomorrow as well, NDP leader. That's on the way. Have a great Tuesday.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.